Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Hooten, Judge Riley, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on December 16, 2020. This is our third case on for oral argument this morning. It is A20-0363 Greenwood versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, as you know, please mute your microphone. If you are not speaking, each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can see the clock from the marshal. Please pay attention to your time. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Andrew Earlbeck, counsel for appellant Grant Greenwood in this matter. The brief lays out a number of distinct errors, but I think the cleanest way to begin analyzing this case is with the third basis regarding prosecutorial misconduct. The district court found that the prosecutor did not misstate the law when the prosecutor argued to the jury that they only needed one act to convict on count two. The statute that Mr. Greenwood was convicted under requires multiple acts over time and penetration. That's the H3 subdivision of the first degree crim sex conduct statute. The jury was instructed on the incorrect subdivision 1G, which only requires one act. But the district court correctly found that there was never an amendment anywhere in the record, that there couldn't have been a constructive amendment. And the district court was correct in holding that no amendment occurred. And in fact, at sentencing, then the parties and the court and the prosecutor confirmed that the correct statute of conviction was H3, which requires multiple acts over time and penetration. And then, as a basis for the top of the box sentence, which Mr. Greenwood then received, the prosecutor argued completely contrary to the closing argument and said the jury found multiple acts over time on the count two first degree penetration offense. And Mr. Greenwood then received a top of the box sentence of 172 months.
Can I ask you why? I mean, are you interpreting multiple acts to mean multiple acts of penetration?
That's a great question, Your Honor. Thank you. The law is clear that when a term is not defined in the jury instructions, the jury defines it itself. Here, sexual abuse was not defined. And there's substantial authority, both that the jury could give the definition, the common sense definition to that element.
Well, wouldn't sexual abuse is, you know, if we use the common term, be any kind of sexual abuse, including contact and penetration?
That is one conclusion the jury could reach. But where they're not defined, the jury is free to give its own definition. But secondarily, there are cases finding that in this context, it does constitute, it does require multiple acts of penetration over time.
How does the Shamp case apply then?
The Shamp case said that that jury instruction in that case was permissible, where they defined it as sexual contact or any sexual abuse over time, but did not require that that always be the instruction, nor did it become a model jury instruction. So it doesn't mandate that that is the correct definition and must always be given.
My reading of the case is that you had to have multiple acts, but only one act of penetration. That was my reading of that case.
And that's the jury instruction that was given in that case. But again, here, first of all, sexual abuse wasn't defined. So in that case, it was. And that was how the court defined it, the district court. And the appellate court said, that's an okay definition to use. But it wasn't defined here. And so the jury can give its own definition and a common sense definition, which is borne out by the Begordis case that we've cited, a 2007 District of Minnesota case where the federal district court here is interpreting this exact issue and says, no, under this statute, it would require, under a common sense reading, multiple acts of penetration over time. Additionally, that element.
What case is that again?
Begordis v. Fabian. It's listed on page 3 of our brief. The citation is a Westlaw citation to a federal district court of Minnesota case. I could provide the citation orally if you want.
Yes, but I mean, I'm just looking at the statute, and it's clear, I think we agree, that you need at least one act of sexual penetration under A of the statute, correct? I mean, you need
it. Yes.
But then instead of signifying that it's sexual penetration, it just says the sexual abuse involves multiple acts committed over an extended period of time. If the legislature intended that there be multiple acts of sexual penetration, why wouldn't they say it? I mean, why wouldn't that be there?
We have to interpret the laws as they're written. And multiple courts in Minnesota have found that that is the interpretation to be given there. But there's an additional argument that this could have substantially affected the outcome of the trial. And it's worth noting here that under the prosecutorial misconduct standard, once a violation is shown, so a misstatement of the law under Strawman, then the burden shifts to the state to show that there's no reasonable likelihood that a different outcome would have been had. And if the court looks at the record here, as cited extensively in our brief, the jury was really struggling and taking seriously that when the acts occurred, what acts occurred. They accepted some testimony from the victim and rejected other testimony. And they asked multiple questions about the timeline. So setting aside, I see Judge Frisch, you want to ask a question, so go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think that my question is really, isn't this the linchpin of all of your arguments? And that is, while there may have been errors, or even assuming that there were errors in the delivery of the jury instruction for count 2 and the prosecutor's characterization of the legal requirements with respect to count 2, and notwithstanding the questions from the jury, it appears that the jury ultimately resolved those questions when it found your client guilty of count 3, which includes the disputed element. So I think the ultimate question really is, how would the outcome be any different, notwithstanding any error or misconduct that may have occurred, when there's a conviction that necessarily required the jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt your client satisfied that element?
So if he had been, great question, and if he had been found guilty of and convicted of the crime that the jury was instructed on, not the crime that he was actually convicted of on Mensa's, then the statutory stay of execution basis would have been available to him, and it was not available to him on the crime he was convicted of. And additionally, the omitted element was the basis in the prosecutor's argument on count 2 for the higher sentence, and no sentence was pronounced on.
But that doesn't have anything to do with whether the element was proven beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. That has to do with what the appropriate consequences for the behavior.
Agreed. I was taking a broader reading of the word outcome when Your Honor asked how the outcome would have been different. And so I was starting by explaining how the sentence would have been different. But as far as the conviction itself. There's two arguments there that the linchpin falls in our favor. And the first is that the jury because sexual abuse was not defined, the jury was free to define it themselves. And it's clear from their questions during deliberations that they were struggling with these exact issues. And so we can't say, because there was no interrogatory, special interrogatory to the jury about how they were interpreting sexual abuse on count two, or whether they believed it required multiple acts of, or whether they believed that multiple acts of penetration had occurred over time, or third, which we haven't really discussed here yet, whether those periods of time were the same. That's significant here, because we're talking about acts spread across many years, punctuated by time periods where there is no abuse. And there's a lengthy argument laid out in the brief alongside the issue regarding whether sexual abuse requires penetration or not. Also, whether or not the same period of time was actually used by the jury for count three as they would have used for count two had they properly been instructed that they needed.
But counts two and three are not divided. They don't have different date ranges. I mean, the charging documents provide that those two counts have the same have the same range. I mean, the acts aren't divided. The acts of wrongdoing aren't divided by date.
There were some amendments actually that happened regarding those dates, and it's discussed on page 10 of our brief and a little bit thereafter. Significantly, the amendment that never happened that needed to have for this to have been done correctly didn't occur, the amending the charge.
The date ranges are the same for counts two and three. That's what page 10 of your brief says. And I extended the date ranges for counts two and three. You see that?
I agree the date ranges were extended. The testimony at trial was certainly ambiguous about the date ranges during which sexual contact occurred and then later sexual penetration. And the jury only found that the penetration occurred at most once, with the way its verdict is postured here, without any special interrogatories and without that additional element here. I'd like to just offer some additional supporting authority that is from this court regarding the Strawman case and whether a misstatement of the law in the closing argument is prosecutorial misconduct. There's State versus Watson, which is 829 Northwest 2nd, 626, and that directly addresses the issue. And I'll just offer this one other citation, which will lead the court to a number of published decisions from this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court, and that citation is State versus Reed, 2019 WL 6834820. Both of those cases discuss at length this prosecutorial misconduct issue. And because the burden shifts to, there is a misstatement of the law. The jury was not instructed on the charge that Mr. Greenwood was convicted of. The prosecutor argued the incorrect instruction to the jury after requesting it, saying you only need to find one act to convict on count two.
Well, what about the argument that this wouldn't have made any difference anyway? It wouldn't have had a significant impact on the verdict, because the jury did, assuming that you adopt the legal position that multiple acts include any acts of sexual abuse, that was found as part of count three. Or was it count? Yeah, it's count three. So in that very count that the jury made that determination and found that to exist beyond a reasonable doubt, why couldn't that be evidence that this would have been, if they'd been, they, the jury had been given the correct instruction, they would have found the exact same thing on the other count.
Certainly there, that is to be taken into consideration. However, if sexual abuse had been defined for the jury and had been defined as Your Honor is describing, perhaps we'd be having a different conversation, but it wasn't. And because
you're saying it should have been defined, but it wasn't defined. Is that?
Well, yeah. And the law says that either definition would have been something this court would uphold under existing law. If the court had defined the sexual abuse as requiring penetration or not over time, either instruction would have been correct as to count two, but it was not defined. And where it's not defined, the law is clear. The jury defines it itself. And therefore, the element on count three does not satisfy the omitted element on count two. My time is up, so I will be quiet.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning? Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. All right, thank you. Anytime you're ready.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm Kelsey Kelly and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. I want to first address prosecutorial misconduct since Mr. Earl Beck started with that as part of his argument. When you read the prosecutor's closing argument as a whole, she does not make a misstatement of the law. When she's talking about there only needing to be one act of penetration, she's specifically talking about penetration and not about sexual abuse, which is the missing element in count two, but it was accounted for in count three. The fact that she did not err is supported by the Champ case, which explains that under that exact statute he was charged with, that one act of penetration is enough as long as other acts of sexual abuse occurred. This case only involved acts of penetration and contact. So I don't think there is any other type of sexual abuse that the jury would have been even reasonably considering, since nothing else was presented to the jury to consider. There's also no case law saying that the phrase sexual abuse needs to be specifically defined. Sexual abuse, I think, is a pretty straightforward term that everyone understands and has a common sense understanding of. Next, as to whether there was error in the jury instructions, the state does concede that count two should have had the multiple acts element. However, it was accounted for in count three. Count three was charged as a lesser included offense of count two. So necessarily, by finding him guilty of one act of penetration in count two, and then finding him guilty of count three with multiple acts of sexual abuse, they incorporated all of the proper elements when they made their findings. Mr. Russett, who I'm sure this court is very familiar with, he very concisely and intelligently explained why Mr. Greenwood here cannot meet the Strickland standard and why he was not ineffective. He explained how it could have potentially been a constructive amendment, but most importantly, he explained very articulately to the district court how that missing element was accounted for in count three and how it would not have made a difference on appeal for Mr. Russett to raise that issue for Mr. Greenwood. When you look to the Watkins factors, we already see that the defendant did testify, but the jury totally rejected his testimony and found that the victim here was credible. And it is true that we know that the jury looked very carefully at the timeline here because they did not find him guilty of count one, which did have a different timeline, where counts two and three had the same timeline. So I think the jury did have some questions as to the timeline, and they showed reasonably that count one, he was not guilty because they couldn't show, or they didn't find beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed those acts during the longer timeline.
My understanding was that it was a hung jury. They didn't find not guilty. They just couldn't unanimously agree on a verdict.
That's true. They unanimously couldn't find it beyond reasonable doubt. Yes. Next, this record does show overwhelming evidence of Mr. Greenwood's guilt. And actually on direct appeal, this court already went through the record and did a great explanation of the facts in this case. There were multiple witnesses who were able to corroborate the testimony of the victim and the timeline. The fact that she was very upset when she had been abused by Mr. Greenwood. She gave consistent statements to police and with two different recorded interviews. The state also had an expert witness to explain why there's delayed reporting in this case. But most importantly, as I've explained before, on the third part of the Watkins factors, the jury's verdict accounted for the missing element. There is no question that he would have been found guilty even if the missing element had been there. It would not have changed the verdict, is what I'm saying. If the court has no further questions of me, I ask that the court affirms his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions from the panel? All right, thank you. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just briefly, Your Honor. Mr. Russett, the appellate counsel, didn't address, he didn't testify that he addressed or ever analyzed the prosecutorial misconduct or cumulative error issues. And so his testimony is really silent on that. And it's whether appellate counsel was aware of those issues and chose not to raise them or simply wasn't aware or didn't notice those issues. Either result is objectively unreasonable here, where we have a situation where the state requests an erroneous jury instruction, argues the incorrect law to the jury, obtains a conviction under the wrong statute for the incorrect jury instruction, and then argues at sentencing the inverted facts and law that were not used and were not found as the basis for the upward departure, which is the sentence that Mr. Greenwood received and is still serving. Shamp simply says that it was not an abuse of discretion to define sexual abuse in that manner, in that instance. Many district courts since then have defined it with regards to this particular crime as, in fact, requiring multiple acts of sexual abuse.
But those are not binding on us, right? Any decision of a district court is not binding authority.
Understood. Yes, of course you're correct.
And that would include the federal district court.
Yes, naturally. Correct.
Could I ask you this because I looked at the appellate, in reviewing this and looking at the testimony of the appellate counsel, the counsel basically said, I'm familiar with Sean and I reviewed this issue and I've got, I think he said, a number of decades of experience here. And I assess this as having no merit. Now, why isn't this just trial strategy where he's making and weighing what strategy is the best strategy to approach an appeal?
All of these issues were consistent with the one issue that appellate counsel appealed, which was sufficiency of the evidence. One of the Watkins factors, well, two really, the first two, go directly to the fact that these issues were contested by appellant at trial.
But my question is, when does this, because usually trial strategy is not considered to be, a problem under Strickland.
Agreed. And I was addressing appellate counsel strategy, but to talk about trial strategy, there's no strategic merit to allowing the jury to convict on the highest count, which is then the count that carries the only sentence that the person is serving, to allow that conviction to be found with just simply fewer elements by omitting the elements. And although Shamp is not although the district courts are not binding on this court, the Shamp decision does not state that that is the definition of sexual abuse. It says it was not reversible error to define it that way, and courts continue to define it both ways, and the common sense reading of that statute is that A, the jury must find penetration, and B, must find that the sexual abuse occurred over a period of time. The common sense reading of those two elements together is that the abuse referred to in that crime is the penetration. And that's why many courts continue to define it as such. But where it's not defined, the law is clear that the jury will give its own definitions to the terms using its common sense understanding of the words. And while it's true that the jury may have defined it the way that the state would like it defined here, it's also true, as many courts find regularly, that they could have defined it conversely, requiring multiple acts of penetration over time. And the court cannot say that beyond a reasonable doubt, this would not have been a different outcome at trial if this had been done correctly. And under the modified plain error analysis of the prosecutorial misconduct issue, the state certainly cannot show that there was not a reasonable likelihood the outcome would have been different. Again, my time is up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? All right. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. And this concludes our calendar this morning. Thank you very much, counsel.